You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 9th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, all.
Perry DeAngelis.
Hello.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone. Do you want to know what happened on this day in 1950?
More
sure.
than anything.
Anything but a stupid holiday.
Yeah, it is not a holiday. In fact, it's quite the opposite.
What do you got?
One Mr. L. Ron Hubbard publishes his book on Dianetics, entitled
really?
Dianetics,
Whoa.
The Modern Science of Mental
Surely
Health.
Surely a date that will live in infamy.
I saw that on the boards.
Here.
So there you go today.
Somebody
posted on the boards that you have to read the very first page of that. He said it's the funniest read.
Was he drunk when he published it? Probably.
He was drunk when he wrote it.
That's
Perry, that book is written on a drunken stupor, I'm sure.
Yeah, you could tell.
And then I'm going to write about aliens.
No one will believe this. Everyone will have a good laugh.
Yeah.
So a few news items this week. We do have an interview with Barry Beierstein, a skeptical psychologist and psychopharmacologist, coming up later on in the show. But first,
a super nice guy.
Very nice guy. First, a few news items. I noticed that a new website was begun, which is a very ambitious project. It's called the Encyclopedia of Life, EOL.org.
Rather grandiose.
Rather grandiose, but very cool. And this is I mentioned this just because we've talked a lot about what a tremendous scientific and cultural resource is the internet. And this is a good example of, I think, one of the best uses of it. Basically, what they are putting together is an online free access resource that is an encyclopedia of every living thing. Everything. Every species that is known. Let's say, ultimately, the encyclopedia will serve as an online reference source and database for every one of the 1.8 million species that are named and known on this planet, as well as those later discovered and described.
1.8, Steve?
1.8 million species. That's what this is, I'm reading off their website, that are named and known. They also said when that is done, then they'll start working their way back through extinct species. They said, for example, if we don't include dinosaurs, we'll miss the 8-year-old boy demographic.
Yeah,
that's true.
It's a pretty cool idea. I worry, though,
awesome
about
idea.
Exactly how they're going to go about doing it. Like, if they're going to go like a Wikipedia sort of approach, which would not be necessarily the best.
I thought that's the way they described it, Steve. Do you remember?
Well, I don't think they have anything set down in stone yet. I think they're still working out all of the finer points. Or if they're not working it out, then they just haven't announced it yet. As far as I've seen.
Well, what they're saying now is that it is a collaborative effort. Ultimately, the tens of thousands of people with expertise around the world and their predecessors are responsible.
Yeah, so what does that mean, though? You know, who's going to
be? It means Wikipedia.
They're going to have a steering committee that will be responsible for practical accountability, they say. I'm sure it will evolve. You know, it says, who will be doing the writing? Unlike conventional encyclopedias where an editorial team sits down and writes the entries, the encyclopedia will be developed by bringing together content from a wide variety of sources, whatever that means.
Yeah.
But they said the material will be authenticated by scientists. So it sounds like a Wikipedia with authentication by scientists.
Cryptozoologists will have something to, I'm sure, add to the to the fray here.
Yeah, I'm wondering how long before Bigfoot is in there.
Are there still print encyclopedias out there?
I heard legend about them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious.
I'm sure there is, Perry.
Britannica still making a book?
I once saw
if you looked, you
a nightstand that was made out of a bunch of Encyclopedia Britannicas.
Ooh, that's cool.
You know what? This Encyclopedia of Life is the absolute perfect example of why the internet is a fantastic tool.
Mm-hmm. You mean besides porn?
Yeah, well, everything is sub-porn, right? I mean, everything is below
right.
porn. While looking over the site, I'm looking at the delivery. It's so accessible to everyone. It's just a brilliant, brilliant reason for the internet to exist. This is it in its highest form. This is what people should be doing for the internet.
Yeah, it really is showing how the internet is becoming the repository of the collective human knowledge, you know, of our civilization. It's cool, and we're living through it.
There's also a lot of shit on the internet.
That's true. That's true.
Just thought I'd mention that.
Thanks, Perry.
You're welcome.
You never missed that particular angle of a story.
Well, it's, you know. It's,
Perry, why, you got some sites you want to recommend? What's going on?
They are legion.
Bob, you sent me this next one. You begged me to put this one in. Spider-Man suit based on nanotechnology. What'd you tell us about that?
I didn't really beg.
You were done on your knees.
Okay, let's just
don't even
right
go there. Don't
that.
Even go there. It just seemed appropriate considering the release of Spider-Man 3. The gist of it was an upcoming paper, the Journal of Physics Condensed Matter. Nicola Pugno, professor of structural engineering at Polytechnic University in Turin, Italy, discusses a process he's working on for yet another novel application of carbon nanotubes. Now, for anyone who hasn't heard about carbon nanotubes, they're an allotrope of carbon, along with their more familiar cousins, diamond and graphite, and at least five others. They consist of a cylindrical arrangement of carbon atoms that have many useful attributes, potentially applicable to many fields of science. So,
Bob, what's an allotrope?
It's a stable configuration of carbon atoms, basically.
So you're not talking about a molecule, right?
No, it's still a carbon atom, but you arrange them in this way and you get diamond. Another way, it's graphite. And another way, you've got carbon nanotubes. But it's all carbon atoms. It's all carbon atoms. What Pugno was working on is a process to turn nanotubes into a super adhesive material, which can be used to create a Spider-Man-like suit that would allow most anyone to climb pretty much anything. The technique behind the stickiness is based on a gecko, the tropical lizard called the gecko. They have a famous ability to walk up trees on walls, or they can even hang from the ceiling by one toe. And for years, scientists have been kind of studying this ability. Geckos don't use some kind of excreted superglue. They rely on a rather obscure attraction between molecules called van der Waals forces, or it's also called London forces. These forces occur because the orbiting electrons create a transient electric attraction between molecules. It's kind of a weird way. It's difficult to kind of put this into words. It's the force itself is can be rather technical. So that's kind of like an overview.
So, Bob, how come I can't hang from the ceiling by my toe?
Well, I'll tell you, it all goes down to the hairs on the gecko's feet. They've got these super fine hairs on their feet called setae. Each hair then branches into 1,000 finer hairs that are narrower than the wavelength of visible light. So it's the molecules at the end of these hairs that take advantage of these van der Waals forces and can feel this attraction. Now, the attraction by itself is pretty tiny, but when you've got millions of hairs taking advantage of it, it turns to quite a force. So what Nicola Pugno is proposing is that using nanotubes in this hierarchical structure where each nanotube then branches into multiple finer nanotubes, using that idea based on the gecko, this is what he would bond a pair. I assume he would bond these nanotubes to this suit that would then produce a Spider-Man suit.
So Bob, how does the gecko release, you know?
It's unusual. You would think if it sticks so well, how do they release it? What they've got to do is you've got to kind of peel the foot away. You kind of roll it. So they have a very unusual release method that their foot is designed to just kind of like not pull straight off, but kind of peel off from one side. It just kind of peels it off.
So it's like Velcro.
Yeah. It's like Velcro that would work on anything, basically.
Yeah, you're right. It's easier to pull it that way than straight off. That's where it gets its strength. And
yeah.
Perpendicular
cool.
force.
But the suit's not going to shoot webs out of the wrists, though.
Well, you know, he also came up with a plan for using the nanotubes to create these invisible, super strong fibers as well. But
anything that nanotubes can
do? Do they give you Spidey sense as well?
I'm just curious.
No, they're just still working on that.
But you know, it's funny. They're going to make this suit, and some guy's going to be like, just so revved, you know, like, oh my god, I'm Spider-Man, and the guy is gonna freaking slip and fall like 50 feet and kill himself
neck,
like
right?
in 2 seconds.
You can definitely see that happening. But I have to say, you know, talking about carbon nanotubes, everything I've been reading about it does sound like the new super material of tomorrow. I mean, the potential
right.
seems so incredible. I mean, who knows what will be realized?
I think we should throw billions of dollars at it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Does that even need to be said?
Trillions of dollars.
It didn't need to be said, but I said it anyway.
Okay, thank you. Somebody had to say it.
The free market will do it. We don't need to.
I'm sorry, Bob. If you gather enough nanotubes together and bunch them together, could you drink like chocolate milk through them?
You could, but it would take about 20 years to drink a thimble full of.
I really don't. I'm so.
Take a while.
What the f? But I mean, Bob, and a little slightly more serious question. Is it actually a tube like a straw, or is it a string?
Absolutely.
Yes, it's a tube.
It is hollow in the center.
Absolutely.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Now, that's for one type of nanotube. There's another type of nanotube that's kind of like a nested tube. It's one tube inside of another. And apparently, I just today ran across some like new evolution of the carbon nanotubes. They're calling them nanobuds that might actually be even better than nanotubes for some of these applications. So it's just a huge field that's opening wide.
It's like plastic. You know, it's like what plastic that would modern society, this is going to do maybe over the next 50 years. We'll see, but it seems to be heading that way. The next news item, this is kind of our silly news item of the week. We always have one of those.
What did we just do?
we were just talking about Spider-Man, right?
Spider-Man nanotechnology is serious business.
Okay,
Vander Waals forces.
Right. Just ask the Goblin.
The Canadian MP, Mike Lake, has called for Bigfoot to be protected under Canada's Species at Risk Act. So he wants... Uh-huh. Bigfoot to be listed as an endangered species, along with whooping cranes, blue whales, and red mulberry trees.
Oh, he's crazy. Whooping cranes? Come on.
My goodness.
I mean, where do we even begin with
Where do we even
like
begin?
This?
I know. He says, the debate over Bigfoot's existence is moot in the circumstance of their tenuous hold on merely existing. What does that even mean? Mean. I mean, whether or not
what
they exist
is
not relevant. Their hold on reality is certainly tenuous.
What it means is that guy is fired. That's what it means. You fired. Out.
Either that or he's the next prime minister.
Guys, my favorite quote, he said, when I get species protection for them nationwide, I will make my findings public and I will take this out of the realm of mythology. Now, isn't that taking the cart before the horse there a little bit? I mean, doesn't he know that if he actually produced the proof, then maybe he could get the protection he's looking for?
He's waving it as a carrot. You know?
Exactly. And they even mentioned what his proof actually was. And
maybe it's a Bigfoot carcass, and he's worried he's going to be prosecuted under his own new law.
Yeah.
So he's waiting for some sort of grandfather treatment.
But he's got...
But Bob, just to be clear, you were quoting just there Todd Standing, who's a Bigfoot researcher, not the member of Parliament Mike Lake.
Okay.
Todd Standing said,
"That's important."
He's the one who said, "I will make my findings public." He said, "Bigfoot is real." That's a researcher who's saying that he's got these secret evidence that Bigfoot is real.
Yeah, he said he has 12 seconds. He has 12 seconds of Bigfoot roaming the Canadian Western Rocky Mountains.
You guys think he found another foot in a garbage can?
Oh yeah,
he might have. He might have.
Imagine the best 12 seconds of footage you could imagine. It still wouldn't be good enough.
To think that grown people sit around their living rooms and they talk about Bigfoot.
All right, here's one question I had. Let's say we list Bigfoot as endangered. Then what? What do we do about it?
Then we grant money to
research.
Yeah, of course.
Exactly. Then you start pouring money in.
That's exactly right, Evan.
Then he would put his video on YouTube and we'd all finally believe it because he would have the ultimate proof.
Are people hunting Bigfeet? Are we taking away something, eating it?
What's Bigfeet's
their natural habitat? I mean, what do we do differently?
It goes to a fund so that these cryptozoologists can take that money and study the phenomenon. And
is this a backdoor way of funding Sasquatch research?
Sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, plus you got to hang signs. No Sasquatch hunting, you know. You gotta find all kinds of things I could think of to do.
I have an official Skeptics Guide announcement. Ready?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. This is addressed to the guy, Mike Lake, who wants this done. Mike, grow the fuck up.
I think that your announcement might need to be censored.
You can't say so?
Yeah.
That.
I can't accept I can't accept grow up.
You can't say that.
Another item that is a bit controversial. Parents were convicted of murder for allowing their six-week-old child to starve to death. And apparently, they were feeding the child, who was born at home.
In a bathtub.
It was born at home in a bathtub, and they were feeding it since birth for the 6 weeks of its life. They were feeding it a diet of apple juice and soy milk.
Soy milk, which had a warning on it not to be used for infants.
Right. And apparently the parents were trying to maintain a vegan lifestyle, and they were trying to maintain a vegan lifestyle with their baby. And the baby, you know, starved to death. It lost weight, withered away, and then eventually died.
That's horrible.
The case, you know, all these cases, you know, you try to maybe derive some kind of lessons from them, but the bottom line is they're always messy because there's always lots of other mitigating details about the case. What I found interesting in reading about it is that the parents were convicted for murder. And the prosecutors made the case that they deliberately killed their baby, their infant. Not that the baby died of their stupidity and neglect. Not that it was, you know, that would have been negligent manslaughter or something of that equivalent. So the prosecutors actually made the case that it was deliberate murder.
That's ridiculous.
And I couldn't find anything convincing to make me think that was actually the case.
There is something compelling for that case, obviously, and the baby died. And the fact that the couple, they weren't feeding the baby a vegan diet, first of all.
No.
They were not feeding the baby, and that is the primary reason why
I absolutely agree with Rebecca. They had a medical examiner, a nutritionist, doctors from the hospital, which, by the way, was across the street.
Yeah.
And they said the child was not just fed the wrong diet. It wasn't fed. It was underfed drastically.
Yeah.
And the guy wouldn't take the baby to the hospital or any doctors because he was worried about germs.
Right.
He was afraid of those places.
You know, after reading everything that's been – all the different articles on it, it seems to me that – this is pure conjecture, but it seems to me that they had a baby. They didn't want the baby anymore. They came up with an idea to kill the baby and blame it on a vegan lifestyle that they previously hadn't ever told anyone about. They became vegans to pass off the death of this child.
Did they ever hear of adoption?
Not at all.
Well, I mean, again, that's pure conjecture because according to the grandmother, the guy had all kinds of crazy ideas. I think it's implied anyway by her that they were vegans for some time. That's implied by the mother of the father of the child.
So there are basically two interpretations here. We don't know what the right interpretation is, and we didn't hear the testimony that the jury did. But it is one is that this is all just, you know, a cover or a defense, but the fact is they fed the baby too little, and maybe it was a deliberate attempt at getting rid of it. And that's what the conviction was. So that's what the jury ultimately decided.
It's interesting to note there were four vegetarians on the jury. Perhaps not vegans, but vegetarians.
The other interpretation is that this, you know, Jade Sanders and Lamont Thomas, that they're just dumb and have a lot of quacky beliefs or quirky beliefs, and not that necessarily that just being a vegan is itself, you know, quirky or nonsensical. It's just that their individual beliefs were bizarre. It was beyond just being a vegan. They also could have this really silly fear of hospitals and doctors. I mean, you know, they had the baby at home. They wouldn't, you know, you watch a kid lose weight and waste away over 6 weeks and do not seek medical attention at any time. Yeah, that's, you know, that's either a really bizarre belief system or deliberate.
I can't even think of a belief system, though, that would encompass feeding a child soy milk and apple juice until it dies. Like, you know, and not even enough to let it survive. I mean, there's really no belief system that would encompass something like that.
No, I'm not saying – I'm talking about their individual beliefs. And maybe they thought that this is what it meant to be vegan. And to be clear, you're right. This is not what a vegan would do. I mean, I think they would feed them soy formula and formula that's intended for an infant or whatever.
There are vegan children who survive.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I don't know many six-week-old children that are fed, you know, T-bones. It's pretty okay to have a vegan baby
it's either breast milk or formula for the first year. That's it, right?
I don't see the reason why we should explain the reason why this. There was a bit of a discussion about whether we should even talk about it. Is because I just don't see how this is a case for a skeptical discussion.
Well, the speculation, if you read a lot of the comments on the news articles, there's lots of speculation, you know, not only just the issue of was it deliberate or was it just their own stupidity, but if it weren't deliberate, what is it about the thinking in these people that led them to this? And I think there are some very, you know, irrational components to their thinking. Again, we don't know exactly what they were thinking. We're just inferring this from the stories that we have, that either, again, they had a sort of morbid fear of mainstream medicine and hospitals and doctors, and perhaps also they had some bizarre ideas about what was healthy to feed an infant, and they didn't seek proper advice, they didn't seek proper information, and it led them to decisions which were horrendous. And this is, again, under the assumption that it was not intentional, but just stupid on their part.
I understand what you're saying there, but that, I mean, that's a ton of assumptions to make on something we don't really have all the facts on, when we've got a case that has been made and a jury has made up their mind.
What do you make of the fact that the first time they actually took the baby to see a doctor was on April 25th, 2004, after the kid was dead? That's the first time they brought it to see a doctor.
Really?
I think it was already dead.
That all fits in with the idea that they deliberately did not want this child and murdered it.
Steve and I and Bob were discussing this last week about how parenthood today, you know, it's a right, but we were like, it should be a privilege.
Yeah, you really were saying that, Jay. The rest of we were not saying that. You were saying
the world is going to disagree with me, but you know, I cannot swallow this type of negligence. If these people murdered their baby, that's one thing. But if they were so stupid that their child died because they just simply didn't feed it, these people are
well, they weren't convicted of stupidity. They were convicted of murder,
right?
Exactly.
And are going to jail for life.
For life,
both of them.
That's right. One quick announcement, more of a news item. I'm going to be on the Beyond Reality radio show this Saturday. So this will be like just right as this podcast is being uploaded. This is Saturday, May 12th at 9 p.m. Eastern time.
Now, have you done this show already, Steve?
No, I'm just going to be live. It'll be live, but you can listen to it live. I think it's also then recorded as a podcast that you can then download after the fact and listen to it as well. This is a Beyond Reality Radio with Jason and Grant, and these are the guys who do the Ghost Hunters on the Sci-Fi Channel. But the radio show is new. They've only had a couple of episodes out. I think this is like the third or fourth one that I'll be on. And I'm going to be on discussing demonology with John Zaffis. You guys know who that is?
I think I do.
He's the Warren's nephew, Ed and Lorraine Warren's nephew. Got into ghost hunting with Ed and Lorraine Warren and then went on to a career in demonology. So it should be a lively
discussion.
Did
he badmouth him after he went on to his own career, Steve?
I don't know.
Like everybody
like
else.
Everyone
like
else. I don't know. Maybe not because it was family. But so that's okay.
Steve, have you met him through the Warrens?
No, I don't think I've ever met him.
How about a quick recap on who the Warrens are for new listeners?
Yeah, I guess you're right. So Ed and Lorraine Warren are probably one of the most, if not the most famous ghost hunters.
Well, were, Steve.
Yeah, well, Lorraine is still around. Ed passed away, what, 1 or 2 years ago?
Short
just
time.
Just last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, just last year.
Yeah.
I know we announced it on this podcast, so it's been since we've been doing the podcast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're Connecticut-based, you know, and operated throughout New England. They were most famous, I think, for the Amityville Horror.
Amityville.
Yeah, that they investigated, which they endorsed. To their discredit, so they're basically gullible. They were gullible ghost hunters, and they spawned hundreds. I think is not an exaggeration of spin-off ghost hunting groups throughout Connecticut and New England. I mean, you can't swing a dead cat in Connecticut without hitting a ghost hunter who was formerly affiliated with the Warrens. So we'll see how that goes on Saturday. This, you know, it's possible that this may become a long-term relationship if this works out well. We'll see how it goes.
Steve, you're going head to head with him?
Yeah.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah, it should be fun. Well, let's move on to your emails and questions. First, a number of corrections and clarifications from last week's show.
Yeah.
Now, I have to say, just as a pathetic excuse, last week, as I mentioned at the time, actually, I had just gotten off the train from the AAN meeting, and we had to record the show a day late, and it was right after I got home. I didn't spend as much time as I usually do prepping the show, and a higher than average number of factual errors managed to creep into the show last week. It was totally due to the fact that Perry wasn't around to keep us straight.
No doubt.
Amen.
But the first one is just a straight-up factual error. We talked about the old woman who was lynched for being a vampire in Georgetown, Guyana. And I mentioned that it was in Africa. In fact, Guyana is in South America. I think I was confusing it with Ghana, G-H-A-N-A, which is in Africa. But the story took place in Guyana, G-U-Y-A-N-A.
Is that because you were smoking ganja, Steve? What's going on?
Good so, one, Jay.
Also during that piece, we talked about witch hunts, and we talked about the European witch hunts, which is actually the biggest, longest sustained witch hunt, and in fact, there were many, many deaths. I think I threw out the figure that there were millions of deaths due to the European witch hunts. And there's actually a little bit of a backstory to that, too. At the AAN meeting, which was in Boston, I took a day trip with my family to Salem. And I did the Salem Witch Museum.
Was it scary?
No. My daughters didn't think it was scary.
No, it's a total tourist trap.
Yeah, it is.
There's no fear left up in Salem, believe me.
Yeah. Yeah, it was historical. It was like the history of the witch hunts. And part of the presentation, I think this was the live sort of tour part. They talked about the other witch hunts, including the European witch hunts, and I think that figure stuck in my head from that experience. Although I couldn't find that information on their website to verify that I heard it and remembered it correctly, but that's where I remembered that from just recently. But it turns out that actually for some time there was this sort of belief in this popular belief that there were millions of people killed in the European witch hunts. Figures up to 9 million were quoted by some, although usually to exaggerate the severity of the witch hunts to make a political point or a social point. It turns out that more modern estimates range from about 40 or 50,000 at the low end to about 100,000 at the upper end. So that's still a lot of people, but much, much smaller than the millions.
Mostly women, Steve. Right?
It was 80% women, 20% men.
Well, Steve, I remember reading a piece with you several years ago about the Malleus Maleficarum.
Yes. That's the book that started it all, yeah.
Yeah, the instruction book for the inquisitors and witch hunters and so forth. And that had a range as wide as 600,000 to 9 million. I mean, that's mm-hmm. a big range.
Right.
Of, I mean, that's as much as they can narrow it down, at least at this date.
And well, now so. I think the it's actually been down even further from about 40 to 100,000 now is the range
okay.
that modern historians are putting onto it. The next, well, there's actually four. So number three is, this is more of an extension than a correction. We talked about the Reichstag fire 2 weeks ago, and the fact that some 9/11 conspiracy theorists say that just as Hitler burned the Reichstag in order to justify, to solidify his power and take away the civil liberties in Germany at the time, Bush, pulled off 9/11 in order to justify going to war with Afghanistan and Iraq. And we talked about how silly that is and how poor the comparison was. And then last week, we read an email from a German listener who told us that, in fact, it was well known at the time that the person convicted for doing the fire didn't do it, and that it was pulled off by Hitler's guys, and therefore, they didn't pull off the conspiracy. Well, it was pointed out today in Orak's blog, Respectful Insolence, and he wrote a very, very nice blog summary, which I'll link to in our notes page, that in fact, modern historians think that Hitler's people, the Nazis, did not burn the Reichstag, that it was actually done by a communist, which is what Hitler said, and that it was just a fortuitous event, fortuitous for Hitler, and he immediately seized upon it opportunistically in order to then advance his agenda, basically create a hysterical fear of communists and use that to essentially take away all the civil liberties in Germany, which then later became sort of the standard under the Nazi Nazi rule. So, in fact, and Orak makes the point that is actually the most damning point to make about that as a poor historical example of 9/11, that, in fact, Hitler used that event but didn't do it, and that sort of reinforces the logical fallacy of, I think it's called qui bono, who benefits, saying that if somebody benefited from an event, they must have caused it. Well, Hitler benefited from that event, but that doesn't mean he caused it, and in fact, he probably didn't, just like, George Bush, may have enacted agendas based upon 9/11. That doesn't mean he caused 9/11.
Well, I have read and heard on 1,000 documentaries that it was Hitler's people that burned.
Yeah, you know, stuff. And it's, I think it's still a little controversial, although, you know, Orac makes his case and he cites some very responsible historians. I did a lot of, you know, reading on the internet. Again, I'm not a historian or an expert on Nazi Germany, but a lot of sites either don't mention it at all. They just say this is what happened. They don't say who they don't mention the controversy. Some historians believe that it was pulled off by Hitler's people, although, you know, Orac says that those were less credible, and that the most credible direct eyewitness accounts say that it probably was just this lone guy, you know, a lone nut communist who was trying to, that he was basically trying to trigger a communist uprising against Hitler and the Nazis.
That's
and
good then, work, boys.
Yeah, and then it backfired because it was used to sort of say, see, we have to root out the communists from Germany. So it's interesting. So, and if true, Orac is correct, that is the best point to make about that historical event and why it is such a poor analogy to 9/11. There's also other historical events that 9/11 conspiracy theorists point to. In fact, some of them have the gall to point to Pearl Harbor, saying that historians think that FDR knew about it, or that we knew about the Japanese attack and let it happen so that it could justify our entry into World War II. That's generally considered by historians to be an absurd position. And some also point to the Maine, the blowing up of the Maine, which got us into the Spanish-American War.
Remember the Maine.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, there it was immediately blamed by the press, actually. This is interesting. There are two disanalogies. One is that it wasn't the government that blamed the explosion of the Maine on the Spanish. It was the press. And that McKinley and the government actually did not go there, did not blame it on the Spanish. And in fact, it was also, right now, the best historical evidence that we have suggests that it was probably an accidental explosion. They hit a mine, or there was some coal dust blew up or something. Not that we did it. It wasn't done by the United States. It was just the Spanish didn't do it, and the press was wrong to blame the Spanish, and it did, you know, foment our entry into the Spanish-American War. But it wasn't a conspiracy carried out by the government as a quote-unquote false flag operation. So all of the historical examples that the 9/11 truthers have thrown at us as examples of previous false flag operations are actually have these significant disanalogies. None of them were actually conspiracies carried out by the government in order to advance an agenda. So they're
all disanalogies. Even if there was an exact analogy, right, that was like very, very similar, so what?
You could even acknowledge that, all right, maybe somebody would carry out a false flag operation, even though you can't point to an actual legitimate historical example. But the ultimate disanalogy is in the scope of the conspiracy. It still says nothing about the ability for the government to carry out an operation of the size and complexity of 9/11 and keep it secret without any evidence coming to light or falling into the hands of Bush's numerous ideological and political enemies. So that's the ultimate disanalogy as well. The last bit, this is just an extension. Now, last week we talked about an email discussing electromagnetic hypersensitivity syndrome, and I talked about sort of generically how these syndromes come into being. In the brief time I had to do research before last show, I couldn't find any published studies on it. Now I've had another week to do more research, and I've also had some emails pointing me in some good directions. I wasn't using the best terms in the initial searches that I did, because I think I was searching under electromagnetic sensitivity. In fact, the proper term is electromagnetic hypersensitivity. And when you search under that term, you do pull up some published studies. So there are actually a number of published studies. There's around 30 or so looking at whether or not this thing actually exists. And the basically, if you look at all of the studies that have been published, they're almost all completely negative. And the ones that are sort of weakly positive or have some positive results have some significant limitations to them. So, again, the overall pattern of the research is what you would expect to find from a phenomenon that doesn't exist. There's not just an absence of evidence for this. The evidence that we have is actually negative, says that it probably doesn't exist.
Do you think that woman... She's actually experiencing what she says, though.
The woman that was referenced in the article we talked about last week, who believes that she has this syndrome, EHS, electromagnetic hypersensitivity syndrome, I think she has symptoms. I think right. These people have real symptoms. The question is that the symptoms are coming from something else that is yet to be diagnosed, and they're settling prematurely on a false diagnosis, or the symptoms are based upon either anxiety or depression, or they may be more generic symptoms, you know, the kind of symptoms that, that most people would develop with time. Or they may have some real, just undiagnosed syndrome, and, you know, but this is offered or whatever, they settle upon this. And they're compelled by the nonspecific symptoms, symptoms that don't really go very far to establishing a specific diagnosis. The next email comes from Greg Lloyd, and he writes, "Hello all, just as Randy has his million-dollar challenge, it appears that the creationists now have theirs. Robert Comfort, the minister..." Actually, it's I think it's Ray Comfort. I think
he has Ray Comfort.
Wrong. Yeah, Ray Comfort, the minister in the video with Kirk Cameron, who uses a banana to disprove atheism, has offered $10,000 to anyone that can prove a transition from one species to another. Any takers? From Greg Lloyd in Westchester, Ohio, U.S.
So $10,000.
$10,000. This is a totally insincere fake offer. This is not legitimate
at
all.
Because the goalposts will move every time you come up with something.
It's not Jay. He doesn't have to move the goalpost. The goalpost is so far out in left field, to mix my sports metaphors, that it's worthless. let me read the offer. He says that the $10,000 offer, a transitional form or missing link, is an example of one species evolving into another species. Excited scientists, we're always so excited, thought they had found one when they discovered Archaeopteryx. The fossil led to the theory that the dinosaurs did not become extinct, but rather all turned into birds. Yeah, they all turned into birds.
The Field Museum... That's exactly what we're saying.
I mean, this guy's ignorance of evolution is astounding. But anyway... The Field Museum in Chicago displayed what was believed to be an Archaeopteryx fossil on October 4th to 19th, 1997. It was hailed as Archaeopteryx, the bird that rocked the world. However, Dr. Alan Fiducia, that guy's name always comes up, evolutionary biologist at the University of North Carolina, said paleontologists have tried to turn Archaeopteryx into an earthbound feathered dinosaur, but it's not. It is a bird, a perching bird, and no amount of paleobabble is going to change that. It's from Science, February 5th, 1993. Now, this guy, Fiducia, just for a little background, he has an alternate fossil early bird, you know, lineage that he's pushing, and it's basically totally dead in the water. That's why this guy is citing a 14-year-old quote. So here's my challenge. I will give $10,000 to the first person who can prove to me that they have found a genuine living transitional form. And then in quotes, he explains what he means by that. A lizard that produced a bird, or a dog that produced kittens, or a sheep that produced a chicken, or even an Archaeopteryx dinosaur that produced a bird.
So species prove my outlandish straw man, win money.
Right.
Sure.
Species do not cross no matter how long you leave them. The whole of creation is proof that evolution is truly a fairy tale for grown-ups. Oh, my. This is a monument to this guy's own ignorance. So, yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, Rebecca. This is just a ginormous straw man. No biologist, no thinking person, nobody, I would say, I think I could safely say, thinks that evolution happened by dogs giving birth to kittens, or even worse, sheep giving birth to a chicken.
But it makes so little sense. I mean, he says, show me a dog that produced kittens, but wouldn't that be missing the one thing he's looking for, a transitional form? You know, where's the half cat? Where's the half dog?
Yeah.
Hello?
Right, it's not even transitional.
You got your two end points, but there's nothing in the middle.
What if I came to him with a dog and kittens and said, all right, this dog gave birth to these kittens. Give me the $10,000. I mean, it's...
Good point.
Anyway, so...
And I think this is a good time to mention that Ray Comfort and his lapdog Kirk Cameron got their keisters handed to them by the Rational Response Squad just the other day on Nightline in a debate where they tried to prove that God was real without using the Bible.
Yeah,
which required them to use the Bible repeatedly. It was amusing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, I want to see that.
These guys are so dumb that it's actually a good thing for us because they're out there representing the creationists and they're not good at it. They're really dumb. You know, they're not like, you know, Gish had his shtick down there. Dwayne Gish, he was a good debater. He had the Gish Gallop going. He was a problem. These guys are really bad. They're really bad at presenting the creationist side. I mean, this guy's website, it's a joke. I mean, if you wanted to lampoon the creationists to try to make them look stupid, you couldn't do better than these guys.
And for those who haven't connected the dots, he's also the banana guy and the peanut butter guy.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Steve said, they have a steep hill to climb, Steve. Give them a break. You know what I mean?
I sent them an email from their website and asked them a couple of questions. I do a science podcast. I just have a couple of questions about your challenge. They haven't answered yet. We'll see. If they give an answer, I'll let you know. It was basically like, you know, part one was asking, what are the actual criteria for winning, you know, something? And second, you know, why do you think this is relevant when no scientist ever said that this is, in fact, what happens?
So, Steve, what's the point? Why are they doing this?
It's a stunt. It's a stunt. We got a $10,000 offer and no scientist can match it. That's all. It's just a rhetorical stunt to feed their believers, their followers. So, well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Barry Beierstein. Barry, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Well, thanks very much. Lovely to be here.
And Barry is a professor of psychology, a member of the Brain Behavior Laboratory at the Simon Fraser University. He is also a native of Edmonton, Alberta, so he's joining us from Canada. He also is an executive member of the CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, formerly PSYCOP, and you're a contributing editor on the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine. I'm also an associate editor on the same journal, so we've worked together on that project. So in our discussions before the show, Barry, over email, you mentioned that you were involved in some projects with some students involving herbalism. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, you know, we've long felt that people who sell these things, and you know yourself, not all of them are bad, not all of them are worthless, not all of them are dangerous. But the trouble is, I think that most of the people who sell them don't know which ones are safe and effective and which ones are dangerous and which ones are just worthless placebos. And so what we did was mounted a bit of a sting operation where we sent some students out to variety of places that sell herbs, and I'm sorry to say that one group of them were registered pharmacists. These were duly registered pharmacies that were selling these things too, and they just asked some questions about, in particular, were interested in kava kava because that was a cause célèbre at the time, our ethics review board refused us permission to go completely anonymously, and in a way it was a good thing because, you know, if they said the things that they said to our students after they identified themselves as students looking for information on herbs, you can perhaps imagine what they might have said if they thought these were just ordinary customers were coming to buy. And some of the things they said were pretty outrageous and dangerous. And we sort of expected that from the vitamin stores and the herb sellers and the traditional Chinese medicine people. But we were kind of shocked with some of the things that the registered pharmacist would say, too.
Of course, I have nothing against pharmacists or against pharmacology. By the way, I didn't mention, but you're a psychopharmacologist, right?
So
you have some expertise in pharmacology.
Mm-hmm.
But I have found, just as a practicing clinical physician, that a lot of professionals who are not MDs have felt a little bit empowered by the alternative medicine movement to do therapeutic modalities on their own initiative without a physician. And so in other words, like things that, like nurses could do therapeutic touch without a physician's order or oversight. So they like it for that reason. And I think this sort of falls under that. Yeah. And pharmacologists who are otherwise, or pharmacists who are otherwise, you know, sort of certainly legitimate professionals, now with herbalism, hey, they could practice herbalism without just following the orders of a physician or other oversight. So do you think that that is part of the allure, that why some pharmacists are falling into that?
Oh, sure. I mean, this is a huge moneymaker, as you know. In fact, a lot of the big herb companies are actually owned by the big pharmaceutical companies.
Yes.
They don't advertise the fact, but it's a huge moneymaker. And as you know, in the United States and here in Canada too, the people who sell these things have been very successful in getting laws passed to their benefit that treat these things as foods, not as drugs. And of course, they make drug-like health claims about these things, about their safety and about their efficacy and what they'll work for, and that's sort of thing, and yet they don't have to pass the same stringent rules of safety and effectiveness that pharmaceuticals do. And I think that's outrageous.
Right. It sounds like what you found is that they indeed were using them as drugs. They were making claims for them as drugs, and they
absolutely. They were Health Canada here that ostensibly regulates these things. Used to be fairly stringent about not letting herb sellers make actual medical claims, you know, for particular diseases and particular effectiveness with symptoms and things like that. But that has largely been diluted to the point, and even if the law were more stringent than it was, I mean, people pretty well ignore it.
Yes.
And what our students found was that these people were quite willing to make medical diagnoses, medical recommendations, and to recommend herbs for medical conditions, and that's what kind of shocked us.
Right. So in order to get their favorable legislation through, they say what they have to say, and they basically present it as, you know, these are used as supplements and they don't make medical claims, et cetera. But in practice, all that goes out the window. Once they have the green light to sell these things, they're practicing medicine without a license. That's the bottom line.
That's right. And I know lots of people in the regulatory industries regulatory agencies in the U.S. and Canada, and I have very high respect for them. These are people of knowledge and integrity, but they're just absolutely swamped. I mean,
yeah.
The volume of this sort of thing, and they can't watch everything that comes into the country, and that's another big problem, the amount of adulteration and from offshore things that are mislabeled or contain pharmaceutical ingredients that are not listed and are not legal to sell without a prescription, and contamination and adulteration both in the growing and in the preparation and storage stages and things like that. I mean, people just are not aware of how much of a risk they're taking when they put their health in the hands of these people that sell these things.
That's right. By the way, I mean, this is just out, so you probably haven't seen this, but in the there was an article published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings that this was surveyed people's use of herbs, and just to see how many people were following the current evidence-based guidelines. And what they found was that basically two-thirds of people who purchased herbs or used herbs were treating medical conditions and were outside of the evidence-based guidelines, which is, you know, pretty bad, and that's basically in line with what you're saying. So again, this was published just this week.
Oh, great. Well, I haven't seen that, but I will surely look it up because it's important. And the other offshoot of that, of course, that you know very well, is that a lot of people use these things and they're slightly embarrassed by it, or they think their family physician or specialist, for that matter, or will be disapproving. And so they use these things themselves, and then they don't tell their doctors. And of course, many of these herbs will interact with pharmaceuticals that they've been legitimately prescribed by their doctors, or in many cases the enzymes that break down the active ingredients of the herbs are the same ones that detoxify the prescription drugs they're taking, and,
right.
And if the doctor doesn't know that, of course some fairly serious interactions or overdoses of that sort can occur.
Yeah, I think the prior survey showed only about 20% report their supplements to their physicians because they don't think that they're drugs. But the bottom line is that what you're saying is herbs are drugs. That's the bottom line.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If they are biologically active and they're capable of interacting with body systems and affect symptoms, well then, yes, of course. And you know, that a huge number of drugs that have been purified and are used every day in scientific medicine came out of a herbal background. It's just
right.
that, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. There are many, many, many plants that have very useful and even safe, effective ingredients in them. It's just that we know what those ingredients are. We can purify them. We know the doses to take, and we can regulate the doses, which of course is very hard to do in the kind of administrations in weak teas and things that herbs are generally consumed in. And so I'm not hostile to these things at all. In fact, I teach a big section on ethnopharmacology in my drugs course that I teach here at my university. And it's just that I want these things to be pure, and I want them to be tested under proper blinded and randomized clinical control trials. And if they pass for, first of all, safety and then effectiveness, well then I have no quarrel at all with them.
Barry, what are the regulations with regard to herbal supplements in Canada? We've talked a lot on our podcast about the regulations in the United States.
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof, the DSHEA, so-called Dietary Supplement Health and
yes,
Education.
Yes, exactly.
Effort. What does Canada have?
Very similar kind of thing. I'm sorry to say that the Health Protection Branch of Health Canada used to be very stringent about these things, and our former Minister of Health, a couple of ministers ago, was kind of a new agey, a touchy-feely sort of guy, and he thought that these things should be more available. And of course, there's an ethnic aspect to all of this too, and a lot of ethnic communities that are important in the Canadian political context. We're also putting pressure on their elected representatives and so on to legalize and deregulate these things. And the people who put a lot of money into advertising and marketing these things were very generous with their campaign contributions. And so anyway, the bottom line is that I'm sorry to say we're not better off here than you are in the USA. There is an Office of Natural Health Products, but it's run by a naturopath, and I've written stuff you probably know from articles we've written for Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine that they believe an awful lot of pseudoscientific stuff, and he's the director of the whole thing, and a lot of the people who sit on the regulatory board have direct conflicts of interest. They're involved in selling and marketing and these kinds of things. And if there were a parallel thing like that where the big pharmaceutical companies had huge influence directly on regulatory boards that oversaw their sales, I mean, people would be up in arms. But they don't seem to think this is such a bad idea, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, it's interesting how the promoters of herbs and also just alternative medicine in general have been so successful in creating a double standard for themselves, and you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a lot of legitimate scandals in this country about the pharmaceutical industry having too much influence over the FDA, for example. And yet, here you go. You got the wolf in charge of the hen house, where the all of the CAM regulations are all proponents, people with clear conflicts of interest are put in charge, and there's no outcry about that. There's this incredible double standard.
Exactly.
Hey, Barry, do you have any drugs in particular that you have a personal problem with or that exceptionally upset you?
Herbs, yeah.
Herbs. Oh.
What are the worst ones?
The worst ones. Gee, that's a difficult question. Ginseng is one that worries me because, for instance, it can cause real problems with people with diabetes, for instance, and it is so, ingrained in the culture that everybody thinks of it as totally innocuous, and it's got digitalis-like substances in it that people with heart conditions shouldn't mess with, and it has so many different ingredients in it that there are probably a lot of people who shouldn't use it, certainly not without strict medical supervision, and I'm not quite sure what a trained medical doctor would prescribe it for, but that's one that that comes to mind that that worries me. Kava that we looked at works in the brain on the same receptors that the benzodiazepines do, and so what worries me there is that it's interactive with all kinds of sedatives and with ethyl beverage alcohol, and again, people don't know what they're taking and they don't know what they ought not to take with it, and kava, I think, is in fact probably one of the safer and one of the perhaps even more useful herbs if it were taken in the right doses at the right times and not in conjunction with other things, but that's what we found in our surveys was that people weren't getting those cautions and recommendations, and people just have this scary notion that if anything is natural, it's safe. And I point out to them, that tobacco is a natural substance, and some of the most virulent poisons known to human society are the mycotoxins that come out of mushrooms and things like that. So there's no guarantee that anything that's natural is necessarily going to be safe. And yet people have this very starry-eyed, romantic view that these things can't harm them, and of course they can.
I bet you hear a lot, but Barry, it's natural.
Oh, absolutely. germs and viruses and prions and so on, they're all natural too, but I don't think I want any of them in my body if I can keep them out.
Just to switch gears here a little bit, Barry, you actually were invited to China to look at traditional Chinese medicine. Can you give us a summary of what you found?
Yeah, in fact, the report of what we saw, Wallace Sampson, who of course is the founding editor of Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine, and Andy Skolnick, who's a well-known science writer, and I were asked to go and visit several of these sites, and we actually wrote up our experiences in the Skeptical Inquirer. Basically, we were treated extremely well. I mean, these people really wanted to show us everything, but I'm sorry to say that the practitioners of traditional Chinese medicine in China are not as well integrated with the scientific community as they claim, and we often hear here in the West, and that in fact we were the guests of the Chinese China Association for Science and Technology, sort of like the AAAS in China, and what they really wanted us to see was that these people really are standing alone much more than we tend to think of, and that, you know, the vast majority of medicine in China is of scientific sort. It's not Western. It's just scientific medicine, and they do it as well and thoroughly as we do or anybody else does. And you know, again, for historical reasons, political reasons, do have a parallel traditional system, but it's relatively small. What we were told is something like maybe at most 20% of medical care comes through the traditional system. And of course, where that came from was after the revolution, there were only a few thousand Western-trained doctors in all of China, which was already 600 million people at that time, if I remember correctly, and they had to do something. And so the barefoot doctor tradition got started, and they did some really good things in public health and improving the potability of drinking water and in perinatal nutrition and obstetrics and things that didn't require a lot of high-tech machinery and drugs and so on. But at the same time, they just didn't have the money, they didn't have the training, they didn't have anything to get, you know, full-fledged scientific medicine out to everybody, and so they kind of concocted this fiction that Chinese medicine was not only as good, but it was even better, and it was a badge of political reliability to prefer it. Well, of course, we now know that Chairman Mao and all the cadres of the Communist Party and all the bigwigs of the military and so on, they never used traditional Chinese medicine at all because they had the best that money could buy, but they couldn't afford to give that to everybody, and so they spread this notion that acupuncture was as good as chemical analgesia and stuff that just was never true, but became very popular.
It's all propaganda.
Absolutely, yeah, and it succeeded very well.
But it sounds like from what you're saying that traditional Chinese medicine in China is on the wane, and they are instituting scientific medicine as much as they can afford. Is that about
I
right?
think that's a very apt way of putting it. That there are a number of Chinese academics who are speaking out now, and you know, I must say it, at some danger to themselves. I mean, they're not going to be purged like they were during the Cultural Revolution, but we were talking earlier about well-placed allies of the alternative medicine movement in the U.S. and Canada. Well, same thing there, that a lot of the people who promote traditional Chinese medicine are well-placed and well-protected in their political system as well, and so these academic critics, I've been back to China a number of times, and you know, they don't really need us. They understand as well as we do what the problem is, but they do kind of need our support, and that's really what people like me have done.
And just to shift gears a little bit again, still more to your psychology work. As a skeptical psychologist, one of the things that you've contributed to the skeptical movement is a study of, you know, how people are deceived. Why is it that we tend to arrive at conclusions which are false or the product of as you say, self-deception and wishful thinking? Let's talk about that for a minute. So, have you done studies in that specific area?
Well, I've stolen most of them. My mentors in this are my fellow psychologist James Alcock from Toronto, yep, and Ray Hyman from the University of Oregon, who really are experts in that area of it. But I certainly have read a lot, and if I've contributed anything, I've tried to bring the knowledge that's been accumulating in areas like cognitive psychology and social psychology to bear on this problem that we've talked about already in this discussion, that if it were just the case that foolish, ill-educated, low IQ people bought into outrageous ideas that don't work and are even harmful, well, that would be too bad, but that wouldn't require any explanation. I mean, that's what you would expect. But what survey after survey shows is that when it comes to belief in all kinds of things that the best scientific evidence we have, say, are dubious at best, if not outright disproven, and that a lot of the people who believe in these things are not ill-educated, they're not foolish, they're not particularly gullible, certainly not stupid, and that's where we need to find some kind of explanation, that there have to be some kind of psychological payoffs that make people kind of willfully blind to evidence that argues against their pet hypotheses and things that affect their self-esteem and things that are central to their worldview and that sort of thing, their basic philosophy. And there's a lot of stuff in those areas of psychology that that can be used to try to explain in this and other areas why people who aren't incapable of understanding these things and wouldn't make the same mistakes in other areas will make real serious bloopers in areas that have these kind of payoffs for them or they have to protect because they're part of their self-image and things like that. And so there is quite a lot of psychology out there. I can't take credit for having discovered it, but maybe I've at least picked a useful bit of it to try to explain some of these phenomena that we're faced with all the time.
So do you think it's mainly the motivation to believe that overwhelms their logic?
I think that's a big part of it, that critical thinking and logical thinking is not our default mode, so to speak, that what cognitive psychologists and people studying the brain have come to realize is that we didn't evolve to be logic textbooks by any means, that we evolved kind of quick and dirty thinking methods that get things more or less right most of the time, and that in our evolutionary past that was probably more advantageous than really careful parsing of data and making decisions by strictly logical rules and things like that. And so those things work well enough in a lot of situations, but they also lead us down the garden path in a lot of areas, especially where there are those emotional things we were talking about, or these payoffs for believing and so on. And so what we say is that our brains are capable of learning logic and we're capable of critical thinking and that sort of thing, but it's a learned add-on. It's something you have to be taught. It's something you have to practice. And maybe more than anything else, you have to learn to take your lumps, because if you apply that kind of critical thinking to your own beliefs, it's not always all that nice an experience. That none of us likes to have our cherished beliefs questioned, and when we do, various psychological defense mechanisms kick in to try to defend them. And so the critical thinker, first of all, has to learn to how to do these things, and then develop a big enough commitment to finding the truth that they're willing to do the sometimes unpleasant job of pricking their own balloons as well as somebody else's.
Right. It's easy to criticize other people's beliefs.
It's
hard to criticize your own.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there one heuristic or fallibility that you find is fairly dominant in leading people astray? No, that's probably an impossible question to answer, but what would you say?
I do have a candidate for that, and
okay.
It's the ubiquitous tendency to mistake correlation for causation.
Mm-hmm.
That our brains are superb correlation detectors, and we find patterns and things. Sometimes they're real, and sometimes we impose them on random input. And one of the first things that we have to learn as critical thinkers is to not fall into the very easy, almost natural trap of thinking that just because two things go together, that one necessarily caused the other. And, so I took that herb and my pain went away, so the herb must have done it. But the logical structure of that argument is exactly the same as I danced and it rained, therefore rain dances must control the weather. And, and when you put it that way, everybody will say, oh yeah, of course, you know, but when it comes to, you know, I had a backache and so I went to the chiropractor and I got better, I say, well, but how do you know you wouldn't have got better or, just as fast without doing it or with doing something else or whatever? And you know, this idea of a control group, you know, if I could snap my fingers and make one universal change in the way people think about stuff, that would probably be it, because the lowly control group is the most important innovation in trying to tease apart what is really causal and what's merely coextensive or correlational.
All right. Well, Barry, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Great. Well, nice job. I hope your project continues to thrive.
Thank you very much. We look forward
thanks,
to having
Barry.
You back sometime.
Good night,
okay.
Barry.
Take
bye
care.
Bye,
Barry.
Good to talk to you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 genuine and 1 fictitious, and then I challenge you all, as well as my panel of skeptics, to tell me which one is the fake. This week, we have another theme. The theme is planetology.
Oh, boy.
It's about planets. Ready? Item number 1. The rover Spirit has discovered evidence of recent, meaning less than a few million years, volcanic activity on Mars. Item number 2. Meteorologists have published a paper showing how global warming will shorten the length of the day. Shorten the length of an Earth day. And item number 3, astronomers have discovered an extrasolar planet with a surface temperature of 3,700 degrees Fahrenheit. And for comparison, Mercury's surface temperature gets up to about 800 degrees and Venus gets up to about 900 degrees. Jay, why don't you go first?
The rover Spirit discovered evidence of recent volcanic activity. I have things that I could say right now, but I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what to say about that one. Meteorologists have published a paper showing how global warming... Steve, I'm going to select the one about the volcanic activity on Mars as the fake. That's the fake.
How come?
Well, because if there was volcanic activity on Mars that recently, there would be more obvious signs of it on the planet.
All right, Bob, go next.
This one was tricky. 3,700-degree planet... I'm going to go with that one. Number...
You mean you think that's real or that's fake?
I think that is real. That is real. Number 2, this one initially seemed completely implausible to me. The Earth shortening the day, I mean, that has to do with the Earth's rotation. And at first I couldn't really think of a way that the Earth's rotation would be affected by global warming. But if you consider that somehow the melting of the ice caps kind of redistribute the mass... around the Earth, it could impact the spin of the Earth, which would, of course, affect the length of our day. And even, you know, we can measure spin changes in you know, rotation changes in nanoseconds. I mean, so even a minor change, that's plausible, I guess, now that I think about it. Number 1, evidence that volcanic activity on Mars. I'm surprised. I think I would have come across that. That's fairly big news. I did not see it, and that's less plausible than the others, so I'm going to go with 1, the volcanic activity on Mars.
Okay, Rebecca?
False.
I'm going to go against the grain. I think that there's no such thing as a 3,700-degree planet, because that's just ridiculous.
It's just too damn hot.
It's too damn hot.
Okay, Evan?
Yes, I have to agree with Rebecca that there is no such thing as a extrasolar 3,700-degree Fahrenheit planet. At least that we've discovered yet.
Okay, Perry.
Well, this one was very tough. You know, they all seem fake. They all seem like fiction. I mean, the first one, the rover Spirit has discovered. Hello, skeptics, don't believe in spirits. The second one, meteorologists have published paper on global warming. Blah blah blah. You know, meteorologists? I don't think so. And finally, the last one. You know. I went with that one because that's really, you know, really hot.
It is hot.
Going
you
see
that
guy
was the fake.
Really, really
big and hot.
Hot,
just like you, Perry.
That's a fake one, yeah. 3,700 degrees. Yeah. It's too hot.
I mean, water would be almost boiling.
almost.
You'd have to wear sunscreen everywhere.
Okay.
That's
hot. So, yeah, Bob and Jay on the recent volcanic activity on Mars and everyone else on the really hot planet, which means you all agree that meteorologists have published a paper showing how global warming will shorten the length of the day. You all think that that's real. Bob, you actually hit that one on the head. What they calculated is that the change in global temperatures can redistribute the water on the planet, actually will make it so that there's more water towards the poles, and that just like a skater pulling their arms in, that will cause the equator to come in a little bit. Conservation of angular momentum, it would make the planet spin up a little bit faster, which will shorten the day by a little bit.
No!
By how much, you might ask?
Sorry.
Seconds, right?
So this is Felix Landerer of the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany. And he this is published in the March 28th journal Geophysical Research. And he thinks that the day will decrease by 0.12 thousandths of a second.
Oh.
So watch out for that.
That's
another horror of global warming.
You know, I mean, stand the death of the polar bears, but
that is going to throw me way off.
Everything off.
Imagine you wake up and the day is shorter.
What will you do with your watch? Let's go to number one.
Nice.
Bob and Jay, you thought that...
I'm not afraid.
The rover Spirit finds evidence of recent volcanic activity on Mars. You thought that was fiction.
Yes.
And in fact, that one is fiction. Woo-hoo. That is fiction.
Yeah.
He's got that one correct. But this is based on a real story. The rover Spirit did find evidence of Martian volcanic activity. However, it's billions of years old, not millions. So it's ancient, not recent. Mars's crust completely solidified a long time ago, and there is definitely evidence of volcanic activity on Mars, like volcanoes. But none of them are active. There's no active or recent volcanism on Mars. So they found what they call pyroclastic flows, what they think are pyroclastic flows.
They are cool.
Which means that, number three, astronomers have discovered an extrasolar planet with a surface temperature of 3,700 degrees Fahrenheit is science. And this was pretty extraordinary. Actually, I didn't know how tough that one would be because I wasn't sure if you guys would realize how absolutely extraordinary this is. It is astounding. This, in fact, they're having a hard time understanding how the planet could be so hot.
Well, how close is it to its planet?
Yeah, I mean, like many of the extrasolar planets, this one is both big and close to its star. So the planet is HD 149026b, and it is simply the most exotic, bizarre planet, says Harrington, who's involved in the research. So they basically said the high heat would make the planet grow slightly, so it would look like an ember in space absorbing all incoming light and glowing a dull red. So
a
basically
growing planet?
Glowing.
What do you think it is?
Glowing.
The planet would glow slightly. They said in order to be this hot, it would have to absorb almost all of the light falling on it, which means it would have to be absolutely black, black, black.
Low albedo.
And it would have to radiate only in the infrared. So it would basically be absorbed all light, it would radiate infrared, and it would glow, so it would be black, but with a slightly glowing dull red. So he said this planet is off the temperature scale we expect for planets, so we don't really understand what's going on.
They said it's off the hizzy?
Yeah, it's off the hizzy, yeah.
It's
so
shizzle.
It really... They've only measured the surface temperature of a few planets. You know, they really, of all the planets, they've discovered 230 extrasolar planets, but this is only the fourth where we know its temperature. So it's kind of amazing that the fourth one would be so far out of the range that we know how to explain that we're comfortable with. That's it. So either that's a somewhat, big coincidence. It's not cosmological, not huge, out of 230, but it's either quite a coincidence or... maybe we're going to find a lot of really more interesting stuff when we start looking closer at these extrasolar planets.
And to put it into perspective, lava is 2,000 degrees.
Yeah.
So this is almost twice as hot as what's required to melt lots of different types of rocks.
Yeah. It's real hot. It's outside the comfort zone.
It could melt
the
steel.
Goldilocks zone, as they say. Could melt steel. Don't get crazy, Evan. Don't get crazy.
Come on. Fire can't melt steel.
We have a new conspiracy
here. I'm going to say they poured lava on the World Trade.
Stupid.
All right, well done, Bob and Jay. Evan, tell us week's puzzle,
Centuries
please.
Ago, a labored magician's trick. I'm a king, I had to know, and sent my wise men quick. Her hair was not concealed, they believed but never thought, and later was revealed this fraud was at my fort. And the answer is Mary Tofts. Mary Tofts.
Mary who?
T-O-F-T-S. A maidservant from Godalming, England, in 1726. She became the subject of considerable controversy when she hoaxed doctors into believing that she had given birth to at least 16 rabbits.
Transitional species.
$10,000,
please. Thank you.
So what did she get out of doing that? What was the point to it?
Life wasn't quite so boring for her.
They fed her.
A couple hundred years later, jerks like us are talking about her.
It has to do with a miscarriage she had, apparently.
Did anyone get that, Evan?
Yes, actually.
Evan, is that where the Easter Bunny came from?
No. Oh, God, no. The Easter Bunny came from Easter Island. We all know that.
Everyone knows.
Congratulations, Adam Price from Seattle.
Ooh, a real name.
Not a name like a planet somewhere.
That's just his board's name. His real name is McPhilly Switz, you know?
127. Okay, well, good job,
Adam.
What's the puzzle for this week?
We have a nice short puzzle for everyone this week.
Good.
All right.
Quite well.
Here we go. In a skeptical context, if I've been cut up and cured, what has happened to me?
So you're saying surgery is not the answer.
Correct. Think skeptical, folks. That's the trick. And
let's not give hints away.
Good luck, everyone.
I have a surgeon friend who likes to say the only way to heal is with steel.
That's right.
Oh my God! Does he say it like that?
Sounds like a surgeon.
I know a chiropractor says the only way to heal is to steal. So, you might have been
onto
something.
Evan, you are clever.
I see what you
Thank
did
you.
There.
You are clever.
Yeah, well, I have my moments.
You're a card.
Terry knows how to deal a meal.
Move on.
Where's the edit?
I can't
button?
Follow it. Yeah. Okay, your humor is much too sophisticated for me.
We need a control Z for this podcast.
Bob, what's the quote of the week?
I have a quote from Albert Einstein. The most beautiful experience we can have is the mysterious, the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true art and true science.
He didn't say that.
Did you validate that source, Bob?
You're fired. Okay.
Define
Ladies
validate.
And gentlemen, I'll be taking over the quotes next week.
Perry, you're going to take over the quotes?
I'll take it over.
All right, Perry will do a stint from now on. We'll spread
it
around.
That's right.
All right. That was a good quote, Bob. I like that one.
Very good. Very good quote.
Well, thanks everyone for joining me again.
Thank you, Steve.
A fun time.
I like joining
you. You're awesome.
Good episode.
So smart.
A hoot and a holler.
Stop sucking up, Jay. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Endless delays.